You know, I never noticed it before, but the sign outside is very impressive, isn't it? Seattle. What does it say? Seattle. Insight. But what's impressive is the light, right? This is for somebody like me who's interested in words, to see letters lit up, you know, with light behind it. It's very impressive. Maybe the best sign I ever saw for a meditation center. So congratulations. Well, I live, she said, in Muir Beach, and in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have a weekly Dharma seminar. So this past spring, in our Dharma seminar, we decided, Frank Ostasevsky, who's a good friend of mine, had just published a book about death and dying, so we decided we would have our seminar on death and dying and read Frank's book, and Frank came to our seminar and spoke to us. And we had lots of older members in our Sangha. So it was very poignant, you know, to have this. It's been about, I think, 6 weeks on this subject of death and dying. And in the middle of our seminar on death and dying, two of our Sangha members took it to heart and actually died. It was rather startling. One of them came to one of the meetings. At the very end of the evening, he said some quite astonishing words about what a privilege it was to be able to die and to be with people who were dying. And then he went home and died. Like within a couple of days after that, it was rather startling. So it was a time of sitting with the body of our Sangha friends, and we have a lot of rituals in Zen that we do at the time of a death. So that was really something, you know, that was really something. And I'm never doing a seminar on that subject again. But then after that, we said, well, now I think let's study the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. And this is one of my favorite sutras from the Pali Canon. And we've studied it actually before in our seminar. And it was really nice to study it again, especially after, you know, that 6 weeks or so of studying about death and dying, because it's the sutra of the Buddha's last days, as she said. So tonight I want to speak about the opening part of the sutra, and then I'll continue through the weekend to go through it, reading some of it with you out loud, and then making some comments maybe. I'm not sure how often you will hear about this particular sutra in Vipassana circles, because usually what you want to hear about is the sutras that give that are the most thoroughgoing in giving teachings that are relevant for your practice. You know, the mindfulness sutra and sutras like that you hear a lot about, and this sutra also contains teachings, but mostly the teachings are given in shorthand, not explained very much. And mostly there are no new teachings in the sutra. They're repeated teachings that appear in other sutras. And when you think about it, it seems perfectly reasonable that at the end of his life, the Buddha would have given all the teachings he felt were important and necessary. So, you know, at that point he had really nothing new to add. He was just reinforcing things he had already taught. So that's why the sutra is not particularly important for its Dharma insights, so much as it is, at least to me, for the story that it tells about the Buddha's last months and days. So we can think about, how did the Buddha do this? How did he prepare his community for his passing? And exactly what were the circumstances of the last days and moments of his life? So this sutta is about 50 pages long or so. It's the longest sutra in the whole Pali Canon. It's the longest sutra in the Digha Nikaya, which is the long discourses. There is actually another sutra, a Mahayana sutra, with the same title, Maha Parinirvana Sutra, though that one is usually referred to simply as the Nirvana Sutra. It's way longer than 50 pages. It's thousands of pages long, running to several volumes, 3-4 volumes. And it's also about the Buddha's last months and passing into Nirvana. But as you may know, the Mahayana Sutras are always way longer than anything in the Pali Canon. Long, extravagant, and repetitive. In fact, they're called Vaipulya Sutras. Vaipulya meaning extended, vast sutras. In Mahayana Buddhism, the idea is that the teachings were set forth originally very simply and suggestively in the beginning, almost like a sketch. But that later the Buddha went into vastly more detail to bring out the fullness of the teachings that were in the beginning not so explicit. So Mahayana Buddhism doesn't deny or denigrate anything that isn't in the early Buddhist canon. It only proposes to fill it out, expand it, even to show its hidden implications. Of course, from the point of view of a Theravada Buddhist, this might feel a little offensive, you know. And Theravada Buddhism classically doesn't recognize the validity of these sutras, which it considers to be, you know, later additions to the canon that was already really closed. But in our time and place here in the West, I think all Buddhist practitioners recognize all of the Buddhist sutras as worthwhile, and they use them if they find them useful. The main thing about the Mahayana sutras is that they emphasize compassion. They emphasize the necessity of practicing for the benefit of all, rather than practicing for self-awakening. From the point of view of Mahayana Buddhist sutras, self-awakening is sort of makes no sense. It's like a contradiction in terms. Mahayana Buddhism is based on the emptiness teachings, which say that how could there be self-awakening, that there really isn't any such thing as a separate person anyway. There's no self, there's no other, so how could you awaken unless everybody awakens? Anyway, the truth is that the Mahayana Sutras don't really add detail or explanation to the original teachings as much as they add poetry, extravagance, and dizzying cosmic content. For instance, in the Parinirvana, Maha Parinirvana Sutra that we're going to study this weekend, as we will read, the Buddha quietly passes away, lying down on one side between two trees. in the Nirvana Sutra, the Mahayana version of the same story, the Buddha reveals that actually he is eternal, that he never really appeared, so how could he go? He says this in the Nirvana Sutra. Before we're done, maybe I'll read you a passage from that so you get the flavor. So let's begin with this sutra. First thing that happens is that Ajatasattu, the king of Magadha, decides that he's going to conquer the Vaijins. As it says in the texts, he decides that he wants to destroy them. He wants to bring them to ruin and destruction. So he sends an emissary to the Buddha to see what the Buddha thinks of this idea. So I think you're a little surprised by what the attitude of the Buddha when this emissary appears with this question. You would think, you know, wouldn't you, that the Buddha would say, don't do it, you know, don't fight, don't kill, don't destroy, it's against the precepts, it's a bad idea, you shouldn't do it. But he doesn't say that at all. He seems to accept that going to war is more or less what kings do. So he doesn't protest. He doesn't talk about peace. He doesn't talk about the futility of war. Instead, as he often did when asked a question, he didn't respond to the question. He asked some questions. So he asked the emissary a series of very specific questions about the Vaijins. And he learns from the responses to these questions that the Vaijins are, on the whole, a fair and reasonable bunch. They have frequent meetings to talk things over among themselves. When they meet peacefully and carefully. They're not contentious. They don't yell at each other. He learns that they are people who honor their own past and are aware of it, respect the elders of the community, respect their religious leaders, and do not do cruel things to women. Now, it seems surprising that this would be mentioned, that they do not do cruel things to women, but it is very specifically mentioned in the list of things that are characteristic of the Vaijin people. And certainly in the Buddha's time, societies were intensely patriarchal and not that concerned, I would suppose, about the treatment of women. And yet it seems that the Buddha specifically asks this question about the treatment of women and discovers that the Vaijins treat women without cruelty. So when he hears all this from the emissary about the Vaijins, the Buddha says, well, since the Vaijins have these characteristics, they will be very hard to conquer. He doesn't tell the emissary what he thinks the king should do, but he just says, well, you're going to have a hard time conquering a people that has this much fairness and goodwill in their community. So the emissary goes away, thinking to himself, well, maybe I should advise the king that it would not be a good idea to try to destroy the Vaijins by force. Instead of sending an army, we better use propaganda to little by little turn them against each other so that their squabbles will eventually weaken them, and then later we can conquer them. That's his conclusion. So this is the opening episode of the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, in which the Buddha, at least for the time being, averts a terrible war in that way. However, I think the reason why that is mentioned is because this encounter gives the Buddha a good idea. So he gathers together all the monastics in the area, because they were spread all over India, but he gathers everybody who was around together, and he gives them a talk about the importance of communal harmony and how the Sangha can survive and continue to thrive into the future. And he gives them many, many lists of things that they should do as a community to ensure their survival. But mostly they amount to things like meeting together frequently, meeting together in harmony, honoring the past, honoring the tradition, honoring the elders of the community, holding firm to the practice, keeping the monastic rule pure, not having too many desires, and so on. In other words, he reiterates to them at this point in his life a steady, stable, and essentially conservative approach based on a foundation of individual moral cultivation and harmony and fairness interpersonally. Since up until this time the Buddha was always around, and everybody from the beginning of the Sangha could count on his presence, there was no particular need for reflection on how the Sangha would survive and prosper in the future. The Buddha was always there, and one would have thought always going to be there to explain the teachings, and in case of disputes or problems, there could be new rules proposed as there was need. But now, the Buddha's getting old, and perhaps for the first time, giving some advice about how to carry on after he's no longer around. So then the Buddha went off traveling, as he always did. He was sort of wandering here and there. It's funny, you know, now that I think about it, I don't know that there's much ever said about why did he go here and why did he go there. You know, he just went here and there. Anyway, he's going around, and wherever he goes, he keeps giving the same Dharma talk, which is repeated over and over again in the sutra. And here's what he says. This is morality. This is concentration. This is wisdom. Concentration, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with concentration, brings great fruit and profit. The mind that's imbued with wisdom becomes free from the corruptions, that is, from the corruption of sensuality, from the corruption of becoming, from the corruption of false views, and from the corruption of ignorance. That was the talk that he gave over and over and over again. Maybe the sutra just gives you the outline of the talk. Maybe he said a lot more than that. Maybe those were just his notes, you know. But that's what he said over and over again. So the trouble with immorality, with doing shoddy or nasty or tricky things, is that it makes you nervous. At least, that's what the Buddha thought. He must have observed this among the people of those days, and he must have seen it in his own mind. I remember once by now it's quite a long time ago, seeing a movie with Dustin Hoffman when he was, there was a while there when Dustin Hoffman was the star of almost every movie, you know. And he would give great performances. And in this movie, he played a thief who robbed jewelry stores. And it was a very compelling performance. It was actually hard to watch this movie, because this thief was a very intense, hyper-focused, and very anxious and jittery guy who could not help himself from pushing the limits, always pushing, pushing, pushing. He could not stop himself. And you would be going crazy watching him push the limits until he pushed beyond the limits, and then he'd get caught. Like, there's one scene where he's robbing a store and the alarm, you know, of the jewelry store is going off, and you're saying, "Dustin, just leave, go, go, now." The police are getting him coming, you know, but he can't stop. He gave just one more necklace, you know, one more ring. And you're saying, "No, no, no." And then sure enough, he takes one too many and then he gets caught. And he goes back to prison. He's in and out of prison through the whole movie. This was like really some performance. And later I found out that this movie was based on a novel, because I heard this guy on the radio who actually, the writer of this novel actually was a crook who robbed jewelry stores until he, in prison, started writing and discovered that he could make more money writing about being a crook than being a crook. No wonder the novel was, the movie was so realistic, you know. And like I say, Dustin Hoffman was in those days a great actor. So maybe it's still true that not practicing ethical conduct makes you very nervous. Even if you don't care about being ethical, still, being dishonest and tricky actually does make you nervous, because it casts shadows in your mind. It makes it difficult to think or act or speak in a simple, calm, straightforward way. You're always wound up looking for the angles. You know, you don't know yourself anymore, what's true and what isn't. I guess the Buddha's assumption in thinking this is that people naturally want to do good and be good. That's sort of the natural way for human beings. But then, inevitably, something goes wrong, something happens, and they're not good. And they don't think about being good. And maybe they don't want to be good anymore. Maybe they end up doing terrible things all the time, very far removed from their natural goodness. And if they're doing that, this inevitably makes them nervous and upset, even if it doesn't look like it. Because deep inside, this kind of behavior goes against their human nature. Anyway, apparently, this is what the Buddha seemed to think. I suppose he was a person who had a lot of faith in humanity, which is, in general, despite much evidence that would have you not have too much faith in humanity, is a good idea. It's a good idea to have faith in humanity if you're human, right? Because if you're human and you don't have faith in humanity, then you don't have faith in yourself, and that's a tough road to hoe. Also, I think the Buddha's humanity was more than just a hope. I think it was based on his experience of awakening, his experience of his own universal humanity. So we can take heart in this and assume that as we too keep on practicing, we will develop this kind of faith in humanity ourselves, despite all the things we see that human beings perpetrate that are not good. We don't lose our faith in humanity. And the Buddha felt that all sentient beings had the nature of Buddhas. They had Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha. The Buddha did not see himself as unique and special. At least, so it says in the Mahayana version of this Nirvana Sutra. It doesn't say this exactly in the Pali version. Anyway, the point here being made by the Buddha is that in order to meditate, you have to calm down. You have to be more or less straightforward and clear-headed. You have to be able to face your own pain and confusion rather than act out, right? Because that's what happens when that's immoral conduct, is acting out of your own pain and confusion, perpetuating the terrible things that might have been done to you. And you won't be able to meditate if you behave like that. So, in order to practice meditation, this is what he's saying in this short little Dharma talk that I read, in order to practice meditation, you have to have a strong practice of moral conduct, which basically means that you have to be able to face your shadows and face your pain, which is not that easy. No wonder people don't want to do it. And it actually is difficult for crooks to meditate. Or anyway, it's difficult for crooks to do Buddhist meditation. Maybe they can do crooks meditation or something. But not Buddhist meditation. As you know, there are a lot of Buddhist meditators who go into prisons and offer Buddhist meditation practice in prisons. And these programs are incredibly successful and very moving, because what happens when they go into prisons is that if the prisoners will actually meditate, it will cause them to face everything they might have done, the pain they might have caused, and the pain that caused them to cause pain to others. They have to face all that on their cushions. It's not too easy. But when they do it, it is very, very powerful and moving. When they shine light into the shadows in their minds, their lives are changed. Even though they're still in prison, they're free sometimes. So, as the Buddha says, the concentration that he's advocating in his Dharma talk is imbued with meditation, saturated. Sorry, not meditation, morality. Imbued with morality, saturated with morality. It's not just laser focus concentration. In fact, crooks probably have really good laser focus concentration. That's not the issue. If you're going to be a jewel thief, you better have laser focus concentration. I think crooks are probably like really concentrated and skillful individuals. But that's very different from Buddhist concentration, which, as the Buddha here teaches, must be saturated and imbued with morality, with goodness, with kindness, with caring, with unselfishness, with a capacity to courageously face the pain of what has happened to us. And there's nobody who escapes, right? Bad things happening, small or large. When concentration practice is imbued with this quality of morality, it becomes more than just focus. It becomes soulful. It becomes true. And then this kind of concentration saturated with morality then saturates, itself saturates wisdom. And when wisdom is imbued with concentration, that is, when the wise and kind heart now has some depth and some strength beyond the personal, beyond the emotional, beyond the rational intelligence, then, as he says, the mind will become free from the corruption of sensuality, of becoming, of false views, and of ignorance. And this is called freedom. This is called awakening. This is called liberation. So the mind is free from sensuality, meaning the mind, the heart, can appreciate the senses and the beauty of the world without becoming enslaved by them. The Buddha seemed to have some powerful intuitive understanding of the addictive personality. He basically thought that being human was having an addictive personality. It wasn't just limited to people who we would identify as addicted to something. He thought everybody is addicted to something. And these days it's so obvious, there's a 12-step program for almost everything now. Because almost everybody is addicted to something, right? Compelled by our desire, our need for this or that. If not substances of some sort, then maybe information, entertainment, gossip, more food, or even, and maybe especially, our own pain. We become addicted to our own pain and the drama of our own lives. To be free of the corruption of sensuality is to overcome our sensual and emotional addictions, to be able to safely enjoy our life in this world. Second, we become free of becoming. This one sounds funny, right? Free of becoming. What does that mean? It means to be free of the need to always be more, have more. Free of the constant nagging discontent that seems to go along with being a human being. Why? Because the human mind has the capacity to imagine, when it's hot, that it could be cold. To imagine, when the body is old, that it used to be young. In other words, no matter what condition we're in, there is always something more, or anyway different, we could be, or we might wish to be. But when the mind is imbued with real wisdom, we overcome all that, and we are free to be as we are and be fully content. Finally, the mind imbued with this special kind of wisdom is free of false views and ignorance. This entire vast setup of conceptions and viewpoints that we don't even realize we have, and that makes us miserable and keeps us mad at one another all the time and dismayed at the world, we're free of all that too. especially we're free of the deep-seated ignorance that leads us to believe that what is impermanent is not impermanent, that what does not exist as we think it does exist as we think it does. Free from false views and ignorance, it actually becomes possible for us to love the world just the way it is, not the way we think it could be, but just as it actually is. And we can love ourselves and our lives just the way they are, without improvement and without too much confusion. Anyway, that's my little commentary on the Buddha's short Dharma talk that he was going around giving at this point in his life. Next, the Buddha traveled on to Pataligama. Probably if we could find a map, an ancient map, we could sort of trace the Buddha's steps as he went here and there. He went to Pataligama. And here he gave a teaching about the five disadvantages of not practicing ethical conduct. So he's pretty focused on ethical conduct at this point. You might think he'd be focused on deep mystical truths, but no. He's focused on ethical conduct. Would you like to know the five disadvantages of ethical conduct? I'll tell you. First, that is, I don't think I said that right. The five disadvantages of not practicing ethical conduct, that's what I meant. Sorry, I might have said it the other way around. Right, the advantages of ethical conduct, the disadvantages of not practicing ethical conduct. Right, okay. So the first disadvantage is you will not be prosperous, because you aren't honestly taking care of things. Maybe you're going around making tricky deals. Maybe you're, you know, way over leveraged, and this is going to eventually catch up with you. So if you're honest and straightforward, this won't happen. Secondly, if you are an immoral person, you'll be known as an immoral person, and you'll have a bad reputation, and this will have many negative consequences. Third, if you are immoral, you will become paranoid of people, which will cause you to either have to be false, brash, and outrageous to cover up your paranoia, or it'll make you nervous and scared. Fourth, if you practice immorality, when it's time for you to die, you'll be a mess. Terrified, lost, it won't be pretty. And fifth, after you die, really bad things are going to happen to you. Now those are five disadvantages of immorality. So then the Buddha went to Kodigama, and before giving the usual Dharma talk, the one I mentioned, he spoke again, as he had spoken. How many times did he speak, beginning with his very first Dharma talk, about the Four Noble Truths? It would be an interesting thing to go through the entire canon and see how many times did he mention the Four Noble Truths, countless times, in 45 years of practicing. And there's no record of the Buddha in 45 years ever taking a vacation. No record of that, or a day off. He just traveled around for 45 years. In all that time, he must have mentioned the Four Noble Truths countless times. And here again, in the last period of his life, the last months of his life, he talks about them again with full conviction. Next comes a kind of a funny episode. With Ananda that took place while the Buddha and Ananda were staying at the brick house in Nadika. A number of people in the Sangha had died, and Ananda was sort of thinking, gee, I wonder what happened to those people, you know, after they died. So he made a list of all these people, and he went to the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha, what happened to this one, and what happened to this one, and what happened to that one? And the Buddha patiently told Ananda what happened to each one of these people. This one was an arhat, had entered parinirvana at the time of their passing. This one was nearly an arhat and would, in the in-between stage after death, certainly enter nirvana. This one had maybe one more lifetime to go, and so on through the whole list. And at the end of all this, the Buddha said to Ananda, Ananda, you know what? This is really tiresome, my having to tell you all this stuff. In the future, just in case I'm not around, I'm going to tell you how anybody can assess their own spiritual state. All they have to do is look into the mirror of Dharma. If you look into the mirror of Dharma, you'll be able to know your spiritual state. What is the mirror of Dharma, you may want to know? Well, I'll tell you. There are four elements to the mirror of Dharma. The first one is unwavering confidence in the Buddha, which means really unwavering confidence in Buddha nature, in the human possibility that all of us possess, the capacity for awakening. If you have that confidence and look in the mirror, you know your spiritual state. Second, unwavering confidence in the Dharma, that there is a way to practice and understand your life that will for sure lead to awakening. Third, unwavering confidence in the Sangha, that there are actually in this world, this Saha world that we live in, which is by its nature highly imperfect. Despite that, there are in this very world more or less trustworthy people who also have faith in the Buddha and do live the Dharma and will support you. And that furthermore, all being actually supports you. So those are the first three elements of the Dharma mirror. And the fourth one is, wouldn't you know, that the person practices ethical conduct. She's not willfully selfish. She doesn't do harm. She refrains from evil. She does good. She purifies the mind. And if you look into the mirror and you see those four elements present in you, then you know that you are an arhat, or at least a once returner or a non-returner. You're on the path and will for sure realize its ultimate fruits. So then the Buddha went to Vaisali, where he stayed in the grove of Ambapali, who was a courtesan, and there he gave a discourse about mindfulness. And he said, pay attention to your body. Pay attention to feeling, to perception, to impulses, to awareness itself. Forget about making progress, being a hero, saving the world, being rich or good-looking or healthy, and just devote yourself to paying attention. That's all. Pay attention to walking forward. Pay attention to walking backward. Pay attention to your robe. Pay attention to your bowl. Pay attention to eating, drinking, chewing, swallowing. You should even, he says very explicitly, pay attention to pissing and shitting. He mentions these explicitly. So Buddhism is the only religion I have ever heard of in which pissing and shitting are considered an integral part of spiritual practice, which is a good thing. Pissing and shitting are also mentioned quite a bit in Zen also. Excellent venues for mindfulness, I recommend. Pay attention all the time. When sitting, walking, standing, lying down, when speaking, when being silent, just pay attention. Next comes a funny story about this courtesan, Ambapali. What's a courtesan, anyway? A courtesan is more or less a fancy, high-class prostitute, a kept woman. And many high cultures have such traditions, such classes, usually of women. And I was recently reading a novel of Flaubert, A Sentimental Education, in which one of the main characters is a courtesan, like Ambapali. Such women move in exclusive circles, yet they're not really exclusive people. So anyway, this is Ambapali, a courtesan, and she comes to visit the Buddha because he's camped in her grove. She owns this grove. And later on in the sutta, she's going to give this grove to Buddha. That happened a lot. He would have these places that people would give him all over the place, and he would go on his annual rounds, usually make his way to these particular places that had been given to him. And she gave him her grove. So she goes there, and she invites the Buddha for a meal, and he agrees to come by saying nothing. That was the way he would accept an invitation, by saying nothing. So I guess it was a pretty prestigious thing, you know, to invite the Buddha for a meal and for him to say yes. So she's very pleased with herself, you know, about this. So as she's leaving the Buddha's camp, probably really thrilled that the Buddha's coming over for dinner or lunch, she runs into the Lachavis, who were, it seems, a very important high-born clan of the region, certainly more important socially than any courtesan could be. And the Lachavis had heard about the Buddha being in town, so they right away got up their best chariot, put on their finest clothes, and got themselves, the sutra says, all dolled up with red and blue makeup. So now we learn that in India in those days, men wear makeup. Makes sense, like, you know, in the bird world, you know, the birds, the males are more colorful. So I guess in India, the men, red and blue makeup. So they, maybe they showed up with red and blue faces all painted up. They were very excited to go to the Buddha. But just as they were approaching the Buddha's camp, at that very moment, Ambapali was leaving, and she more or less, I mean, the sutra is a little bit coy about this, but more or less she like purposely ran into their chariots with her chariot, blocking the road so that they couldn't get past. What it says in the text is, she met them axle to axle, wheel to wheel, yoke to yoke, pretty much. Like that. And they said, what's wrong with you driving into us like that? And she said, with, we imagine, you know, great pride and maybe even a little taunt in her voice, because I have invited the Buddha to a meal and he is coming. And they were shocked. And they said, we will offer you 100,000 pieces of gold if you will give up that meal and let us have it. And she said, no way. And they said something like, damn. Defeated by a mere courtesan. So they went on to the Buddha's camp and they invited the Buddha. But the Buddha said, oh, I'm sorry. I have already agreed to have the meal with Ambapali, the courtesan. And once again they said, damn. Defeated by a mere courtesan. So this, by the way, shows the Buddha as a person who is not discriminating between supposedly better or supposedly worse people. Also, as someone who, once he's made an appointment, will keep it. So in these Pali sutras, you know, stuff like this happens a lot, actually. That's why I like to read these sutras. You know, I like these kind of stories. Because it's a little realistic, you know. I mean, all religion is idealistic, but these sutras are not 100% idealistic. They're a little realistic. Yes, we can imagine, you know, in the Buddha's time, there was jealousy. And people were using their relationship to the Buddha to increase their prestige. Or maybe just to, you know, have some personal self-satisfaction. It turns out that even in the days of the Buddha, and even among the Buddha circle, people are always people. Just like now. There's all sorts of rivalries and jealousies. It may be better now, actually, because now we're more sophisticated about pretending, you know, not to be jealous. Maybe then they were just out with it. And even the Buddha, we see, didn't have the magical power to make people stop being jealous and petty. Seemingly, the Buddha notices that this is going on around him, but I don't think he worries about it too much. He doesn't go around straightening people out, telling them what to do or not to do, how not to be or to be. He just does his own practice, and he shares his practice, and he offers the Dharma as he sees fit. And I guess he figures, good luck, I hope it works for you. Anyway, the sutra says he stayed as long as he wanted at Ambapali's grove, and then he went on to Baluva, where he was going to spend the rains, because he would stay put during the rainy time, during the monsoon. So now I'm going to quote directly from the text at the end here. When the Blessed One entered upon the rainy season, there arose in him a severe illness, and sharp and deadly pains came upon him. And the Blessed One endured them mindfully, clearly comprehending and unperturbed. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, it would not be fitting if I came to my final passing away without addressing those who attended on me, without taking leave of the community of bhikkhus. Then let me suppress this illness by strength of will, resolve to maintain the life process and live on. And the Blessed One suppressed the illness by strength of will, resolved to maintain the life process, and he did live on. So it came about that the Blessed One's illness was allayed. And the Blessed One recovered from that illness, and soon after his recovery, he came out from his dwelling and sat down in the shade of the building on a seat prepared for him. And the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, respectfully greeted him, and sitting down to one side, he spoke to the Blessed One, saying, "Fortunate it is for me, O Lord, to see the Blessed One at ease again. Fortunate it is for me, O Lord, to see the Blessed One recovered. For truly, Lord, when I saw the Blessed One's sickness, it was as though my own body became weak as a creeper, and everything around became dim to me, and my senses failed me. Yet, Lord, I still had some little comfort in the thought that the Blessed One would not come to his final passing away until he had given some last instructions respecting the community of bhikkhus." So said Ananda, and the Buddha answered him, saying, "What more does the community of bhikkhus expect from me, Ananda? I have set forth the Dhamma without making any distinction of esoteric and exoteric doctrine. There is nothing, Ananda, with regard to the teachings that the Tathagata holds to the last with the closed fist of a teacher who keeps some things back. Whosoever may think that it is he who should lead the community of bhikkhus, or that the community depends on him, it is such a one that would have to give last instructions respecting them. But Ananda, the Tathagata, I, the Buddha says, have no such idea that it is me who should lead the community of bhikkhus, or that the community of bhikkhus depends on me. So what instruction should I give respecting the community of bhikkhus?" This is a startling, a little bracing saying of the Buddha, you know, in response to Ananda. And we supposed leaders of communities should take comfort and instruction from these words. If the Buddha didn't think that he was the leader of a community, or that the community depends on him, or that he was expected to give instructions to the community, why would we think that? We should do like the Buddha did, just practice with people the best we can, be willing to completely, or anyway as completely as possible, share our lives with others, and then when it's time to stop, we should stop, trusting that everything will be well. "Now I am frail, Ananda, far gone in years. This is my 80th year, and my life is spent even as an old cart, Ananda, is held together with much difficulty. So the body of the Tathagata is kept going only with supports. It is, Ananda, only when the Tathagata, disregarding external objects, with the cessation of certain feelings, attains to and abides in the signless concentration of mind, that his body is more comfortable. Therefore, Ananda, be islands unto yourselves, refuges unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge. With the Dharma as your island, the Dharma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge." So I'll end there, and we'll take up from there tomorrow. We're meeting until 9 o'clock, right? So there's just a few minutes more. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, we invite that.
I guess it is surprising that he would say that at the end. Didn't he see himself as the teacher throughout those 45 years? Did you see, do you imagine he made some shift at the end, or am I understanding?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I think that he saw that he was the teacher, and also saw that he was that was just a role. I think he reacted that way to Ananda because sometimes if a student says, "You're the teacher, you know, please save me, help me here," then that's a kind of projection beyond what a teacher is going to do. It doesn't help you. I think the Buddha was being kind to Ananda. He was saying, "Ananda, you know, don't think that it depends on me. It depends on you and each one." That's why he says, "Be like islands. Everyone take responsibility. Don't depend on someone else." So I think he understood his role in the Sangha. He didn't deny it or run away from it. He fully accepted that responsibility, but he understood that it was just a role and a kind of chimera. You know, it wasn't, "I'm the boss, listen to me, without me you're nothing." I don't think he saw it that way at all. He saw that it was, everybody was practicing. He was always taking care of his own practice, you know. He didn't stop practicing, he was always practicing. Practicing with others. Part of his practice was to open his mouth, you know, and be the person he was in the community. But it was just his practice. See what I mean? It wasn't, "I'm the boss," you know. So he was trying to help Ananda there, I think.
And I wonder how he, if he came upon someone eating a horse or killing an insect, or that idea that everything is our mother. But I mean, I wonder, do you think he just prayed for the whole situation, or?
Well, he did often see stuff like that. All kinds of terrible things happened in his lifetime, you know, very sad things. And he endured them. You know, he could see human confusion and its consequences. But, you know, there is the famous case of Angulimala, you know, the serial killer who became the Buddha's disciple. So he certainly felt like anybody, no matter how horrible they were, had the nature to be a Buddha, if only they would turn to it. And he had the faith that eventually, if not in this life, then in some life, they would. So it's in Mahayana Buddhism, much is made of this idea of Buddha nature. It's like a technical term, you know, Tathagatagarbha, there's whole sutras about it. In early Buddhism, it's not emphasized so much as a concept, but there are definitely suttas in the early canon where the Buddha says the nature of the mind is pure. Everybody's mind is pure, meaning everybody has Buddha nature, but it gets all messed up because of what happens over time. So that which is pure is covered over with all kind of schmutz, you know, and you can't find it anymore. It's as if it's not even there, but it's really there. A Buddha can see it, you know, a person with eyes can see it in everybody. But sometimes the person themselves can't see it, and they go through their whole life and they never see it, and they don't believe that it's there. But the Buddha believed it was there with everyone. I mean, the Buddha's job was to do what he did. He didn't practice, to share the Dharma, to give advice where advice was sought. And he did that tirelessly for his entire life. And when things happened that where he couldn't prevent, he grieved over them. He endured and never lost his faith in humanity or in the possibility that through the Dharma applied as widely as possible, we could have a good world someday. I don't think he ever lost that faith. And as we'll see as we read through the sutra, all the way up until the very end, he kept teaching and interacting with people all the way until he could no longer speak. Yes, this will be the last, I guess. Yeah?
I'd like to ask a general question.
Okay.
If you could perhaps share with us a metaphor which helps to provide dedication and skill with this inner work.
I'm not sure exactly what you're... A metaphor that...
I work as a music teacher.
Yeah.
I find that metaphors can really help to convey that essence. Mm. Of course, I feel perplexed and it's also mysterious.
Why don't you give us a metaphor that you would give to your music students? Probably the same will apply. A what?
A garden.
Garden, uh-huh.
Yeah, and that helps me to understand, it takes patience, it takes effort.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good. I like that. The mind is like a garden. Yeah, it's just like that in Dharma practice. I think Dharma practice is almost the same thing as playing music, actually. The mind is like a garden, and you plant, you hope, you get healthy, good plants, and you plant them in the garden, but you don't make them grow. The air and the water that falls from the sky makes them grow, but you have to cultivate the garden. So you're there in the garden every single day trying to help growth to happen, the growth that happens because it's in the nature of the plant to grow. You don't make a plant grow, but you cultivate it and you tend it and you think about it, and you work every day in the garden, and you prepare the soil. It's very important. If you have like really crappy impacted soil, and you're going to dig a little hole and stick a plant in, nothing will happen. You have to spend a long time turning the soil, painstakingly over time, putting air into the soil as you turn the dirt, making it more friable. I used to actually be a farmer, so making it more friable, and all that. So. Working the soil, putting amendments into the soil. Sometimes you have to prepare the soil for quite a long time before you put the first plant in. And then it's thrilling, right? When the plants start to grow. How did that happen? You know, sometimes you go the next day and you could see how much growth happened when the seedling is small. So, and then you have to protect it from pests. Maybe you put a fence, you know. All kinds of like little pests and things get in there and make a mess, and you have to make sure that doesn't happen. So you're very vigilant. But it's a wonderful metaphor because you don't make it happen. It happens. You put in the effort and it happens. When I was a farmer, I never stopped being amazed, you know, to see an entire field of, we grew lettuce a lot, you know, of lettuces growing. You could almost see them. You know, when the sun came out, you could just see them. It was just thrilling. Thrilling. Because you know you didn't do that. You know what I mean? It was happening because of the nature of these plants and the nature of sun and sky. In Dharma practice, it's just the same. In fact, I use that metaphor. Cultivation is another name for meditation. Cultivation. Cultivation is a really important word in Dharma practice. So, great metaphor. Thanks. Yeah. Well, I'll say good night and thanks again. And I know that some of you are here for tonight's talk and won't be here for the weekend. I hope all of you will come for the weekend. But in case some of you are not here for the weekend, and this is the last I'll see you this weekend, I want to tell you that on Sunday evening, after this retreat will end, that I'm going to do a poetry reading at Open Books, which is somewhere in the city. I forget where. But what?
In Wallingford.
And this is going to be, because you mentioned that I have a new book out. Actually, I have two new books out at the same time. One is called Untitled Series, Life as It Is, and the other one is called On a Train at Night. And these are very spooky, mysterious poems. They're both book-length poems. Each one is a whole book, one poem, serial poems. So if you like poetry, or even if you don't like poetry, but you just are intrigued by what I'm saying to you now, which I hope is the case, then maybe you'll come to the reading at Open Books on Sunday at 6 o'clock. I'm all charged up about these books. They're very spooky. Mystical, mysterious books. You won't understand a word. But all the more reason to come. So thank you very much for your attention this evening. You were very sweet to me to listen so nicely. We've been sitting here for a couple hours. And thank you very much for the invitation. And I'm looking forward to seeing everybody for more discussion of the sutra over the next couple of days.